Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. Welcome to another episode of Seriously. We're going to start with some very, very big news that has just broken and that I know you are feeling pretty broken about, Anna, which is One Direction.
Yeah, the dream is over, but we'll live on in our hearts. Yeah, so last night, just as I was, you know, when you're just like, okay, I'm ready for my early night now because I've got to be up early in the morning. So as I was doing that, my Twitter feed went insane because The Sun broke an exclusive news story that the band are planning on disbanding in March next year. Still got quite a lot of time. But yeah, it wasn't that surprising because they were only contracted for 5 albums. And so the end of that contract is meant to be March anyway. So I was kind of like expecting this. Also, Zayn left. Louis become like soon to be a dad, which shouldn't be something that I'm like, that was really sad news. But for me, it was just like another symptom that everything was breaking apart.
And that they've grown up as well.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. And that they're like adults. It makes me really sad in a way that I find difficult to articulate because people are like, literally Nick Grimshaw on the radio this morning said, I'd be upset if my house burnt down, but I wouldn't be upset about a boy band breaking up, which I completely understand what his point is. But at the same time, it is something, there's something so, that these were children and now they're adults and like we're all getting older and we're all going to die.
It reminds me actually of when, was it our first episode where you made me the One Direction playlist, which I did listen to on the way to work, by the way, in honour / sadness. You pointed me towards that piece about how part of the brilliance of One Direction is that they remind us that everything will come to an end.
All things change. Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that really gets me about this. Also, it's so funny to me when people say, like, I don't understand why you would, like, care about these people. You don't even know them, all that kind of thing. That's the whole point. The whole point is that there are these, like, 4 to 5 bland, pretty faces that an army of wonderful, creative teenage girls have gone out and made into a community and made mean something, and that for me is really like a beautiful thing. So although I can see why this isn't a tragedy that's happening, tragedies are happening literally every day and there are more important things to worry about, but you can say that about anything at all in this world. And actually there's something really lovely about One Direction and the fans and
but
what that means.
Hopefully that community you talk about can live on. I mean, I'm pretty sure they're not going to disappear from the public eye. They're all going to go on and do solo stuff, acting, DJing, whatever. So it won't be the same, but it will still exist.
Exactly. And the thing that I mourn is that it not being the same, not the fact that it's sort of over, because as you say, I don't think it's really over. A fan tweeted, lol, they can kill One Direction but they'll never release us from the prison of fandom, which I thought was quite funny because for a lot of these teens, it doesn't even feel like a choice. It's just like, well, I'm here now. I've invested so much of my life into this, so I'm going to continue. If we do think about these 4 people as actual human beings for a minute, which is something that I don't do that often, they work so hard. They've done over 325 headline stadium shows in the last 5 years. That's insane. That's like, the schedule is nuts. And they never get a break, and I actually think, you know, something terrible will happen if they carry on working this hard all the time. You know, like, Zayn quit because he just felt like he couldn't do it anymore. But what would you do if you just couldn't quit and you had to carry on? And, you know, it'd be awful. So,
well, and actually, yeah, if you sort of look to history and bands that get really big and...
Exactly. Good stuff doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
In terms of them as like real young men who deserve a break, I'm actually really pleased and think that whether it's a break or a full ending of the band, it is probably time.
Going out tonight changes into something red. Her mother doesn't like that kind of dress. Everything she never had, she's showing off. Driving too fast, moon is breaking through her hair. She's heading for something that she won't forget. Having no regrets is all that she really wants. We're only getting older, baby, and I've been thinking about it lately. Does it ever drive you crazy? Just how fast the night changes. Everything that you've ever dreamed of disappearing when you wake up. But there's nothing to be afraid of.
Thing we're going to talk about this week is the podcast Who Killed Elsie Frost,
which is a Radio 4 serial about the real life murder of Elsie Frost in Wakefield in the early 60s. Caroline, what did you think?
I liked it. I mean, there was the obvious comparison that's been made a lot is with Serial, the American podcast that sort of made so much news last year when it was being downloaded millions of times and prompted this kind of real-time online investigation into a cold case. And the similarities are really obvious. It's also, as you say, a real-life cold case murder that was never solved. It's also being told episodically, both being investigated by journalists, but also by sort of, I suppose, citizen journalists doing FOIs and so on at the same time. But the difference is that while Serial was a sort of self-contained spin-off from This American Life, Elsie Frost began as part of Radio 4's PM radio programme, or rather their Saturday version, which I really hate the title. It's called IPM, you know, like iPod. Why Radio 4? Stop trying to sound cool and internet-y.
I thought that stood for something else.
But anyway, so it began as a segment on that and really sort of caught people's imaginations, and so is now being pursued separately as a sort of standalone podcast. And whilst I did enjoy it, I didn't get sort of hooked in the way I did with Serial. And I think this is to do with the key difference in the way around the crime is. Because in Serial, Adnan, the sort of main survivor of the case who the investigating journalist is talking to, he's potentially, well, he is in prison for committing the crime, but he's also the star of the show. Whereas Elsie Frost, she was the victim. And she's not there to talk to you. And I think that was, for me, the missing element.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I mean, I think, as well, there's been a real conscious move away from the Serial style of reporting on this case.
I think it's about trying to find out why it happened. It's important to know who the perpetrator was. But more important than that even is why. Why did it happen on a Saturday afternoon at 4:30?
I mean, it's very Radio 4 in that there's no music. Yeah. It's just voices. It's not edited in the same way. Serial was obviously edited to grip you, whereas this is very much like every few weeks they find out something new, they speak to the person they found out something new from, and it's very contained and it doesn't actually feel like, I'm sure this is a reflection on probably how good their editing skills are, but it doesn't even feel like they've edited it at all. It's just like two people having a conversation and then the conversation is over. So it feels kind of funny for me to say whether it like gripped me or not, because obviously this is somebody's real life and it's not my sort of Sunday afternoon entertainment. The other difference I really felt between this and Serial was that they had the family on board, which does makes it very different, because you are sort of willing them to find out information, but you're also sort of, there's more tension because a lot of people are saying, you know, actually the siblings might not want to find out all the details because some of the stuff that's in this file is really, you know, haunting stuff. It feels a bit more real to me. And it feels less like I want them to find everything out because I feel for them so much more as people. In Serial, the family aren't there. You don't really think about them that much, you know, for better and for worse. And that, for me, changes the whole listening experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's... I definitely felt with Serial at times that I'd forgotten that these were real people. They may as well have been fictional. It could have been fiction, and I would have enjoyed it probably as much. Though maybe there was a slight frisson from the fact that it wasn't fiction. But still, I think the majority of my reaction was quite similar. Whereas you're right, this does feel very serious and very real. Actually, it reminded me very much of quite a famous book that Paul Foote wrote called Who Killed Hanratty, which is about James Hanratty, who was actually one of the last people to be executed for murder, who the journalist Paul Foote and lots of other people believe did not commit the murder that he was killed for. And Foote wrote this long book where he basically followed Hanratty's last movements for the last few days, and he felt conclusively proved that at the very least there was enough doubt to have meant there should be a new trial rather than just the verdict that there was. And I was given this book actually when I first moved to London to become a journalist by someone saying, like, if you want to be a journalist, you've got to read this because this is the pinnacle of what journalism can do. And in the same way as Serial, I think I enjoyed it as it's a real page turner, you know. And then a few years later, I think it was, you know, that period between Christmas and New Year on Radio 4, they let people guest edit the Today programme.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't remember who, but someone guest edited the Today programme who also really cares about this Hanratty case and interviewed the guy's brother. And it turns out there is still DNA evidence on file at the Home Office that if the Home Secretary would give them permission, they could test and probably get him a posthumous pardon, at least, or apologise. But the Home Office so far hasn't allowed this to happen. But so that suddenly I was like, oh, wow, it's real and it's still out there. You know, the book might be finished, but the story isn't over. And that's similarly how I feel about Elsie Frost, that you want to know, but you also feel like you shouldn't know, that it's private, that it's still there.
Absolutely. And I think also there's a much more concrete sense of community and how the murders really affected the community in Wakefield in Who Killed Elsie Frost. Whereas in Serial, it seems much, you know, it's just, they're such different beasts. And I think one of the things that again makes it feel so much more real is this idea that there are still people 50 years later calling up Radio 4 saying, oh, I heard about this. I was in Wakefield at the time. It really changed, you know, everything about my growing up. And yeah, that just really hits it home for you.
Yeah, and I suppose also as you mentioned, the style of reporting is much more focused on those people's stories and not, whereas part of what made Serial feel like fiction to me was that Sarah Koenig, the presenter and sort of lead journalist on it, she told the story from her own perspective. So we found out things in the order that she found them out, and we heard about her responses to things almost as soon as we heard about them. Whereas that's not how they're doing this. They're doing this, as you say, very much as a sort of methodical investigation punctuated by these new facts as they emerge. So in conclusion, do we recommend Elsie Frost?
I think so, but with the caveat that it's not a gripping, you know, true life crime page turner, or I don't know what the audio equivalent of
audio turner.
I do think if you want something like that, the thing to go and look for is HBO's The Jinx, which is very much, although it is again a real life thing, also feels like fiction because it's so truly bizarre and is handled like fiction by, you know, someone with a history in doing fiction shows and films.
If you want information about a fascinating case and a sort of serious and actually quite
very
disturbing,
sad, yeah,
quite sad case, this is more that kind of thing.
Next up, we're going to talk about Paper Towns in both book and movie form, as the movie just came out. I read the book over the weekend. You did as well, Caroline?
Same, yeah.
So, should we start with the book?
Yes. Well, I suppose maybe to give a brief outline of what it's about, the plot doesn't change very much at all, actually, from book to movie, does it? The outline
is
there.
It's pretty similar. There are a couple of differences, but yeah.
And with the usual caveat that we're going to talk about this in a fair amount of detail, so if you really don't want to know what happens, maybe skip to the next segment. The story of Paper Towns is it's a teen story. It's about teenagers. It's about a boy and a girl who grow up on the same street.
The way I figure it, everyone gets a miracle. My miracle was I wound up living across the street from Margot Roth Spiegelman. She was inarguably the most gorgeous creature that God had ever created. Margot's life was a series of unbelievably epic adventures.
Are you going to spend the rest of high school pining for this girl?
As senior year drew to a close, Margot and I were practically strangers. Until this one night.
What the? Margot?
I need to borrow your car.
What?
I have 9 things I need to do tonight.
Can't you just get your boyfriend to do it?
Ex-boyfriend.
And the girl grows up into a sort of mysterious young woman, and the boy grows up into a kind of nerdy, quite literal person. And just before they're supposed to finish high school, they share this one night of sort of petty crime caper, let's call it, where they drive all around Orlando where they live.
It does look so fun, though, and they, for all the petty crime.
Are fantastic. And they enact revenge on all the people who wronged Margot, the girl. And then she disappears. She's gone. And the rest of the book and the film is Quentin, her neighbour, trying to find out... Well, he thinks he's trying to find out where she's gone, but in actual fact, he's trying to find out who she is. And yeah, that's really the rest of the story, is him doing that and his friends helping him and high school coming to an end and all the rest of it.
It's really like Gone Girl without any of the violence.
That's exactly what I thought when I was reading it. I was like, even in the way that bit when they... as part of their kind of little crime spree... At the end of the night, they go up to the top of the tallest building in Orlando to, like, see how it's all going. just in itself quite bizarre. And she gives that little speech about, which is obviously where the title of the book comes from, about Orlando being a paper town for a paper people. You know, nothing there is real. Everyone is artificial.
Yeah.
And that reminded me really strongly of the kind of cool girl speechify bit in Gone
Girl. And also isn't there a bit to do with the paper anniversary and stuff like that?
I don't remember that bit.
There's like it's like the wood anniversary, you know, the treasure hunts.
Oh,
like,
right. Yeah,
and there's
yeah.
I feel like there's a bit where she talks about paper in relation to the paper anniversary and stuff being flimsy. But the interesting thing is basically how this journey of trying to find a person, as you say, becomes about basically the relationship between the two main characters, even though for the vast majority of the book, and one of those characters is just not present.
Yes, and I thought actually that was very interesting in terms of the casting in the movie, because I think it's got quite a bit of press just on the basis that Cara Delevingne is in it, and it's one of her first sort of starring acting roles after having been a very successful model. Having cast someone with that much kind of draw and just like screen presence, to cast her as someone who then isn't in it for an hour is quite bold.
Yeah, absolutely. But I also think it's brilliant casting.
Fantastic. She's really good.
She's really, really good. And it really makes sense. One of the main themes that we're going to talk about a lot, I think, today is this idea that Margot, who's almost always referred to with her full name, which I think is a real thing that reminds me of being at school and having crushes, like calling your crush by their full name. Like, she's always Margot Roth Spiegelman.
Mm.
Quentin, the main character, is really got this mythical idea of her. It's something that obviously Cara Delevingne is going to understand so well, because she's a model, but also she was a model that like stuck her tongue out in a few photo shoots, and everyone was like, oh, this like quirky girl, she's got so much personality, and we like know what that personality is, when obviously she's modelling. It's something she does, you know, she's putting on a face, quite literally.
She's as unknowable as when she does that as when she makes a kind of icy, cool model face.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it really, really works.
And as does her kind of look and appearance, I think, because the whole point about Margot is that she is the queen of their high school, but she's a reluctant queen. She's not a traditional kind of beautiful blonde wearing the sort of latest fashions, you know. She wears whatever she wants. She doesn't do much with her hair, and yet still she has this magnetic force.
Yeah, she has edge, essentially.
Yeah. She's too interesting looking not to play an interesting looking person.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny as well, because I don't want to be mean about the lead guy, but the guy who plays Quentin is like bland looking.
He's also quite, I mean, I'm sure this is deliberate. I'm sure this is part of his skill as an actor. He's also quite gormless.
Yeah. And he's good. He is good at that sort of, he kind of needs to be someone who's like torn between being like awkward and very inward and actually trying to discover a confident self. So he's got that blend, definitely. But he also is, this always happens in any teen film, because this is what happens in real life as well. But all the girls look about like 25 and gorgeous, and all the boys look about 14 and terrible. So yeah, that was funny and a good representation of what it's like to be a teenager. And I think that was basically what I really enjoyed about the book and the best bits of the film, was that it really sort of understands what it is like to be a teenager and what it's like to feel maybe irrationally drawn to another person, and about sort of like discovering whether those feelings are sort of grounded in reality or not.
Yes, absolutely. And the bit that really brought it that home for me was when Lacey, who's supposedly Margot's best friend, but who's one of the people who Margot feels betrayed by after Margot's disappeared, it's the bit where she's sitting in the bath talking to Quentin, and she's talking about another girl, Becca, who has been has now gone off with Margot's boyfriend and is probably going to be prom queen now, and she says she's basically the new Margot. And that reminded me so strongly of being a teenager and being how invisibly to all of the adults around you there was just this hierarchy. And everyone knew exactly where they fitted into this hierarchy.
Yep.
And yep, if anyone moved away or whatever, yeah, you all moved up one place. And so became the new someone else. And of course that made total sense. You didn't have to question it because we all played these fixed roles.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about most in relation to this, which I do think has been discussed a lot, is this idea of not knowing somebody and projecting onto another person. And this all ties into this movie trope of the manic pixie dream girl, films like 100 Days of Summer. This is something that John Green's actually spoken about, I think, pretty specifically when the book came out, which was actually back in 2008. So it's been around for quite a while. John Green said, "Paper Towns is devoted," and this is in caps locks, "in its entirety to destroying the lie of the manic pixie dream girl." Really comes across in both things. Obviously it plays up to the manic pixie dream girl trope as well, because to have that really fun night at the beginning of the book, these two characters, there kind of has to be this element that Margot is really, really like alluring and mysterious. So it spends a lot of that beginning bit really playing up to that idea. But then as Margot literally disappears, that changes quite a lot. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting to get a bit detail-y with the plot is this idea of the paper towns in.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Title, and as you say, she kind of says, oh, Orlando is a paper town, and Quentin kind of is a bit like, really? And then when she disappears, one of the clues she leaves says that she's basically gone to the paper towns, which he in the book decides are these pseudo divisions of Florida.
Yeah.
So he goes around all these sort of, they're basically like new build towns, aren't they?
That, yeah, or like, or even plots of land that were meant to be developed that then weren't developed.
Exactly. And he kind of starts off, the first few towns that he goes to are actually pretty developed, and then as each one that he goes to becomes less and less developed until there's nothing there. And then the real turning point of the novel is when he realizes that a paper town can be a fictional town that doesn't exist at all.
It's a reference to the fictional places that cartographers put on maps as a copyright trap to make sure that they know when someone else is copying their map. And so they're places that exist only on paper.
And I thought that really interestingly mirrored this idea that he realises he's reducing his sort of own conception of Margot to its purest form when he's like, actually, this is just an idea and it doesn't reflect reality at all. So I thought it was quite cool the way at the beginning Margot tells him, oh, Orlando's a paper town, and he can't see that because he's looking at Orlando and he can see the buildings and he's like, these are real people.
Yeah, and he doesn't see that it's a reference to the sort of stories that we tell ourselves about places rather than the place itself.
Absolutely, and I just thought that was a really good way of mirroring his own sort of like internal understanding of other people and that his idea of Margot is not actually real at all.
One of the reasons that I like the book more than the film, even though they are quite close in plot, is that in the book, for about the first third of it, I was quite cross with the book because I completely bought into John Green's Manic Pixie Dream Girl, and I was like, why does she only exist to give Quentin a good time? Why am I not getting any of her thoughts? Why am I not living inside her head? She's clearly much more interesting.
Yeah.
And then once she disappeared and once the book actually started to interrogate the fact that its main character thinks of this girl like that, I went, oh, okay, fine, I see what he's doing here. And that my own transition was part of the reason I enjoyed the book. Whereas I think, I don't know, maybe I feel like cinema should be able to do that. It should be able to play with genre and subvert your own, you know, the you of 10 minutes ago and your own opinions. But this film didn't really do that for me.
I felt when I was reading the book, I was thinking, how are they going to do this in movie form? Because so much of it is just Quentin saying, like, and then I realised this, and then I realised that. And that's really difficult to get across on screen. And so what they actually do to make that transition is they just don't have Quentin really realise anything. And so then when he finally, spoiler alert, finds Margot in a paper town that is, you know, fictional, he is overjoyed to see her in a very romantic, thinks he solved all the clues he was meant to solve.
And now they can be together.
And Margot is like, wait, I'm really surprised to see you, like, what are you doing here? And then, you know, he says, I love you. And she says, you don't even know me. So although it changes the whole sort of narrative flow of the book, I did think, and I think for the worst mostly, I did think that scene was quite a powerful way of saying that this idea of the girl who exists only to make you realise things is false. Though he did then say, but I had the best few weeks of my life because of you, and which kind of ruined it again for me, which doesn't really happen in the book.
I did like the bit, though, when he said that when everyone else was doing things for the last time as high school came to the end, you caused me to do things for the first time. Like, I went to my first ever party, like I cut class for the first time in my whole life. I went on my first road trip. I quite liked that sort of symmetry. But again, there was that niggling thing of, oh, maybe Margot exists only as a way of making the male character more fun, which annoyed me.
Yeah, but they did have that wonderful line where he was like, oh, I don't know where she is now or what she's doing. There's this rumour, there's that rumour, there's another. But that's her story to tell.
Yes, exactly. So they did sort of finally at the very end make explicit the fact that they were trying to subvert that whole idea. But it wasn't quite as... And again, I feel like you should be able to do this in cinema, but maybe it's really hard. It wasn't threaded through in quite the same satisfying way. And also, just the usual things you get with a book-to-screen adaptation. This is the first John Green book I've ever read.
Me too.
But I know him from his, you know, his mammoth online presence, his vlogging, his Tumblr, etc. And I know that he, just as a person, like, he's quite witty, and also he's very, very knowledgeable about the internet. And all the jokes in the book matched up with that. You know, the kind of I am conversations that were reproduced, like all of the main characters had really funny screen names, but absolutely the screen names you would pick if you were a teenager. Mm. And the fact one of Quentin's best friends is an obsessive editor of what they call Omnictionary, but which is clearly Wikipedia. It's like a crowdsourced encyclopedia. And that is at several times in the plot really important, but the rest of the time really annoying because his friend won't stop editing Wikipedia and pay attention to him. Yeah. Those kind of things I really, really enjoyed and didn't really translate to the screen so much. But they did translate the brilliant Black Santa joke.
Yeah, that worked really well, actually.
And that worked really well because it is essentially a visual gag, so that was good. But I think I'm going to read more John Green now. I enjoyed it.
Well, did you like his writing style? Because one of the things that obviously really doesn't carry over to the movie is he writes very, like, imagistically. Mm. Like, there's a lot of... Like, the book is divided into three sections. The names of those sections refer to sort of overarching metaphors that he uses. And to be honest, I found it a bit much. I really enjoyed it at the beginning. There were a few kind of, like, subtle things that he did that I really enjoyed. So, for example, when they drive to that building and look out at the top of the SunTrust building over all of Orlando... Actually, a few chapters earlier, he mentions that he's studying The Great Gatsby just before she pops into his window. And then on the way there, he says, oh, you know, it's near the asparagus. And the asparagus turns out to be a green sculpture that's really called the Tower of Light. So there's this enormous tower of green light next to the SunTrust building, which is obviously, to me, a Gatsby reference and this idea that he's reaching for something that's not real, which I really enjoyed. I thought, wow, what a great subtle little nod to this where this trope maybe, you know, originates or is certainly a massive example. And there's also references to... Moby Dick, things like that. But by the end, I felt so beaten over the head by a copy of Leaves of Grass.
I was going to say, it was the Walt Whitman really that got me.
Yeah,
the extensive quotations and constant references to grass.
Yeah, exactly.
That was maybe a bit too much.
And a bit sort of dodgy things about like boats at the end that were just like, does this make any sense to anyone? I'm a bit... But I do think, for all my like picking apart it, I think actually what a great book to be out there for young people. Mm. It really does pull at a lot of ideas and again really taps into what it feels like to be a teenager. It really reminded me of a Chris Krauss quote. Everything reminds me of a Chris Krauss quote, but she talks of what she calls the psychosis of adolescence, which is not said in a sort of negative way, but this power that you really have, that what's going on inside your head can change the outside world, which is exactly what's happening with Quentin, because he really believes that if he solves this treasure hunt, it will have like lasting ramifications on the world around him. And he has to just like keep sitting there and thinking for the whole book, and then that will like change the world.
And that even though, unlike Margot, he's very secure in what he wants his future to be, like he wants to go to college, he wants to be a doctor, and he wants to get married, he wants to have children. He's really sure about all of that. He's got this idea that if she'll just come back and like either live with his family or get her own place in Orlando for the summer. I mean, obviously he's still going to go to college at the end of it, but if she just comes back for the summer, everything will be different.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it won't. You've deliberately planned so that it won't be, but you're trying to change that exterior fact just with your wishing.
Yeah, it's very good on like wish fulfillment, and she's obviously cuts right to the core of it a lot. So I do think, for all its sort of minor pitfalls, this is a great influence for young people.
Mm, absolutely. Into the moment, like I'm standing at the edge. I know that no one's gonna turn me around. Just one more step, I could let go. Hear the voices and they're calling for me now. I know that nothing's gonna wake me now, 'cause I'm asleep to the sound.
So last week I recommended the wonderful Broad City for Caroline to watch, as I have done with basically everyone I know over like a campaign of, you know, publicity for this comedy. Caroline, what did you think of Broad City?
I had the best time watching it.
Yay.
It was just so funny. It was absolutely the right mixture of kind of character-based stuff, but also just totally surreal things.
Absolutely.
I absolutely love things like that, like 30 Rock particularly, when it in later series when it just got a bit woo, was absolutely my favourite thing in the world. And yeah, Broad City really, really ticked that box for me.
What did you think of the two main characters, Abby and Alana, who obviously like drive the show?
I definitely sympathise more with Abby.
Yeah, you're more of an Abby.
I'm very much more of an Abby. In her sort of drive to, well, she's slightly older, isn't she? And
yeah.
She, in her drive to, like, improve her life while at the same time very comprehensively preventing herself from doing so. I really sympathise with that.
One of my favourite sort of this, because Abby, I think, is a dark horse in that she is also a rebel. But one of my favourite Abby lines that I think sum up her character is when she says, you know, I'm an adult now. I need to be buying my own weed.
Yes, that's exactly what I mean. That this idea that, yeah, I'm a grown-up now. I should take responsibility for making all of my own mess. I shouldn't stop making the mess, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Alana, you just pulled a bag of pot out of your vagina.
I know.
Why would you do that?
I do it all the time. Honestly, it's the safest way to travel.
Apparently, I have been smoking this tainted weed for I don't even know how long. I didn't mean that. This is disturbing to me.
I don't know what to tell you. It's in a bag. And, you know, the vagina is nature's pocket. It's natural and it's responsible.
Shouldn't even be bumming off of you.
Oh, who cares?
No, I'm an adult. I should be buying my own pot.
Wow. Never thought this day would come, you know? I would be honored and pleasured to facilitate this.
No, you dudes. I want to get my own pot, okay? I'm not going to be, like, holding my mommy's hand while I buy drugs. Like, I can do this.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to be a grown-ass woman and do my taxes for once. Without my mommy and daddy. Get bitch.
Yeah, and in the same way, it's got that same kind of New York in the 21st century vibe, young people trying to have great lifestyles whilst having no money thing that Girls and Obvious Child, which we've also talked about on a previous podcast, have got. And I really like that atmosphere.
Though I think they have much more realistic flats in Broad City.
Yes, they
Their apartments and roommates are much more what you would expect.
Yes, and unlike in Girls, Abby at least does have a job that I can understand what it is that she does, and I can see why she would get paid. I mean, she's a cleaner at a gym. Like, that is a job someone has to do. You definitely get paid for that. Part of the joke is, of course, that Alana definitely doesn't know what her job is, nor does it seem like anyone else who works there. And I love how every so often there's just a shot of her sitting at her desk with this thing on the wall behind that just says, deals, deals, deals.
Yes.
And every so often someone shouts at her to make a deal, and she's like,
I do think that, yeah, that's obviously really poking fun at, like, the internet. Like, everyone seems to have a job in, like, online something, and Alana doesn't
apps.
Really know what hers does, but
yeah. And they're kind of, I mean, so, like, I think I watched five episodes.
Oh, great. So you did really enjoy it.
I did really enjoy it, and I'm definitely gonna keep watching. I think my favorite episode of the ones I've watched is the one where they get locked out.
Oh, yeah.
And again, it's this recurring theme that they're of sort of self-improvement disguised as self-destruction. So they've been to Bed Bath & Beyond to buy sort of DIY equipment because they're going to put up a new closet rail in Alana's flat and all the rest of it. And in actual fact, they get locked out of her apartment. A really creepy locksmith comes, and they're too creeped out to tell him which one their apartment
actually live in.
Is. So they tell him it's another apartment, so they sort of accidentally break into someone else's flat. And then they have to leave there as well, and they end up traipsing around Brooklyn for an entire night with a curtain rail and some, like, massive bags full of towels or something.
Which is weirdly, like, how a lot of the episodes end up. Like, there's one where Abby loses her phone, and there's one where they, like, decide to go off-grid, and, like, all these episodes just end up with them, like, wandering around New York trying to, like, do stuff together.
Yeah, right, we've all had sort of weekends or weeks or whatever like that, where a chain of circumstances that seem beyond your control make even the most basic thing really, really difficult. I'm thinking particularly of a few years ago when I lived with two friends, and it just so happened one night one of us was away, the other two of us were both going out to do separate things, and you know, who could have predicted that that would be the night we both left the flat without our keys? So you had two people in London, neither of whom had a key, one person who did have a key but she was in Manchester and wasn't coming back for a week, you know. Suddenly, just the very...
Yeah.
And also, that would be the weekend that we had people staying with us. A whole chain of circumstances end up with us all sitting on the staircase in the building drinking mulled wine that has been pre-mulled from Tesco's, feeling really sad, you know.
Yeah.
It happens. This kind of stuff happens. And very quickly, you've gone from being a person who lives in a flat and, you know, has regular showers to being a person who sleeps on the stairs and drinks mulled wine straight from the
bottle.
Person
with a lot of mulled wine, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know, it feels like, and I'm sure this has been said about Broad City an awful lot, but it feels like the kind of American boy dirtbag story has been told a zillion times, but the female side of that doesn't often get aired.
Yeah.
And this is what this does.
Yeah, and they're not afraid to be really, really crass and really silly, which is one of the things I love most about it. I also really enjoy their friendship. Yeah, they're just, like, so close. And like you said at the beginning, it really means that the, like, character-driven element of it, even though you're, like, laughing at these ridiculous, surreal things, it really, like, keeps you invested in their actual lives, no matter how silly it gets, which I really enjoy. Any standout moments, I could just sit and trade, like, quotes from Broad City forever, but
I think after the one where they get locked out, my other favorite that I've watched so far is the one, I think the title of the episode is Working Girls or something, and it's focused specifically on their jobs. And
is this
so
the one with the giant baby, or is that a different
no one? I think that's a different one, although I did also like the giant baby moment. But no, this is the one where Alana follows this chain of jobs where, you know, she's at her actual job and then she gets a call from a temp agency she used to be registered with, and so she spends a few hours being a temp for the temp agency, and then she's too stressed out by how the stupid computer database works to actually send out any temps, so she herself tries to go and do all the temp jobs, and she ends up walking five dogs.
Yes, I love this episode.
And accidentally returning them all to the wrong places. And there's just this recurring motif of whenever she screws something up and leaves the guy, it's normally a guy, like when she goes back to return the dog and realises that she's returning the wrong dog to the wrong person, and there's this sort of businessman who's like, but where's Cuddles, and then when she leaves to go and find Cuddles, there's just this kind of aerial shot of this guy going Cuddles with his arms up in the air, and that style of shot recurs about five or six times through the episode as she screws things up and people are like, oh, I think I'm missing. And I don't know, that just the rhythm and the editing and everything of that episode was just so perfect.
I love dogs, so it was an extra special episode for me. And I also love Lincoln, her, like, on-off boyfriend. Well, not on-off, her, like, actual boyfriend that she denies is her boyfriend constantly. So Lincoln also really loves dogs, and there's a moment in another episode where she calls him when Abby's lost her phone and she can't get hold of Abby. And she's like, Lincoln, where are you? And he's like, at the dog shelter. And she's like, Lincoln, get a dog. And he goes, Alana, you know I can't inflict the crazy life of a dentist upon a dog. It's just like one of my favourite lines in TV ever. I think he's just such a great character, played wonderfully by Hannibal Buress. He's just so funny. And I also think Bevan, Abby's, I want to say roommate, but actually, like, the joke is that he's her roommate's boyfriend and it's just always there. And it's absolutely disgusting.
I mean, I've watched five episodes and I've not met her roommate.
Yeah, you don't meet her roommate. It's one of the jokes. It's so funny. But yeah, so glad you enjoyed it, basically. A star,
and definitely I don't know if everyone thinks like this, but I have TV shows that are sort of like core TV shows, and then I have periphery TV shows, and this has just been promoted straight into core TV shows. I'll be watching all of it.
Yay, fantastic. So for next week
I'm going to recommend you another graphic novel. We're getting really into graphic novels, actually, in the last few weeks.
We should also say, speaking of graphic novels, we did have a message in from a reader.
Yes, a listener.
A listener. We did have a message in from a listener.
We had an email from a listener, from Harry, who was saying that he really enjoyed our chat about the Wicked and the Divine comics last week, and also recommending us the Young Avengers comic series, which I have actually read a couple of. My friend Alex, who's Wicked and Divine comics, I still need to return. Sorry, Alex. Has already lent me a couple of those. They're by the same writer, illustrator duo as The Wicked and the Divine, and I have really enjoyed them so far, so definitely a good shout, Harry. But so yes, for next week, Anna, I'm also going to recommend you a graphic novel, which is Persepolis by, and I don't know how you say her name, but I think it's Marjane Satrapi.
Okay, cool.
I don't speak great Persian, sorry. Which is, it's a bit like Fun Home. It's an autobiographical graphic novel, but the major sort of point of it is that she grew up in Iran just after the revolution. And so it's all about how she suddenly went from being a schoolgirl who did whatever she wanted to be a school, from being a schoolgirl that had to wear the veil. And her, you know, her family were very political and radical, and, you know, sometimes her uncle would disappear to prison and their neighbours would disappear and there was war and there were bombs, but she was a child and a teenager and she was growing up, and drawing was the thing that she loved, and so this was the outcome of her whole experience.
Yeah, I remember when the film came out, which was obviously really acclaimed, and so I've seen some clips of that, and I did really want to read the novel when it came out, but I never got around to it, so thanks very much for recommending it. I'll definitely enjoy it, I'm sure. Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. I'm Anna.
And I'm Caroline. You can find us on iTunes.
Our Twitter is at SeriouslyPod.
And if you want to send us an email, we're SeriouslyPod, SRSLYPod @gmail.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.